And only a handful of recent scholars, like in the past few decades, have come upon this theory, which is I also hold to, that the name Catskill actually comes from a person's name. So it was very common in the 17th century, especially between the 1620s and 1660s, for the Dutch settlers to name places after prominent local native leaders. So we have examples all over the place, like Papaskani Island near Albany. I'm right next to a stream that flows into Catskill Creek called the Yondabacher's Kill, named after a local Catskill Indian leader. There are many, many more. And we have records of a local native leader between the 1630s and 1640s or 50s who went by the name, recorded name of Kankat or Kat, which might come from the Mohican word Nikankat, which would refer to someone who is leading a group of people or the head paddler in a canoe. It could have all different meanings. Lead dancer. So this leader was only mentioned.
The bushwhacks were some of the worst days I've ever had in the mountains, or life, really.
Whereas Panther Mountain is totally opposite. It's a mountain on top of a crater.
I think the weather challenges on this incident were particularly difficult.
It is really the development of New York State. Catskills were responsible.
Now you're listening to Inside the Line, the Catskill Mountains podcast.
So I'm guessing you heard that. Didn't you hear that, Justin?
Yes.
Good, good. So hopefully everybody hears that when they get on there and they're not picking their nose or something, you know, weird. So welcome to episode 112 of Inside the Line, the Catskill Mountains podcast. Tonight I have on here Justin Wexler. We're going to talk about Native American in the history in the Catskills. And he is a, I would say, a Native American expert, wouldn't you say?
I don't know about that, but maybe. I don't know if I'd feel comfortable calling myself an expert.
Native American.
I certainly have been spending a very, very long time on the topic of Native people in the Catskill Mountain region.
I've been waiting for this, to talk about this for a while, because it's always, there's not enough history about the Native Americans in the Catskills. So to hear about it, there's not a lot of books about it and stuff. So yeah, exactly. So glad to have you here tonight. So one thing, congratulations, Josh Kingsbury, for completing this 3,500. Really awesome stuff. 3,500 Club, welcome to it. I don't know what number you are, but that's pretty neat. Glad you could do it, and glad for you to join the club. Also, Justin, the weather in the past 48 to 72 hours has been absolutely insane. So if you all didn't know, we had a massive snowstorm headed up here for, like, I would say the Northeast at the time. And I live in Oneonta. We, on Sunday, they were predicting in the morning, 7 to 12. Then later on in the day, it got moved to, I think it was like 6 to 9. And then Monday morning, it got downgraded to 1 to 3 inches. And today, I've had nothing but sunshine here. So it's been very odd. One of Alex from Hudson Valley Weather, who does a phenomenal job, was on here before, said this is one of the biggest shifts he's ever seen in a storm in such a short amount of time. And Justin, where you're located, of course, since your name is Wild Hudson Valley, down in the Hudson Valley, where are you down in the Hudson?
We are located on the banks of Catskill Creek. We are about 5 miles from the Blackhead Mountain Range to our south in the Catskills, and 6 miles, I think, from the banks of the Hudson River to the east.
Nice.
So right in between the Catskills and the Hudson River. We've just had alternating clouds and sun. We didn't get anything too crazy in this direction.
Nothing like just like any rain or snow or anything?
No, nothing. Wow. Just the same odd, mild, almost March-like weather that we've had most of the winter.
Yeah, and you know, they predicted that storm was coming right up the valley and gonna nail the Hudson Valley, and New York City was gonna be crushed. Like, everybody was like, prepare. And then 24 hours before, it's just like, yeah, we're basically getting nothing. This storm has shifted so far south that we're getting, everybody was getting so excited. Hey, we're getting snow again. We're going to have another winter, the third winter inside of our winter that's not at all been a winter. So what a crazy time to be alive, to have 50 degree days and then, you know, have a major northeaster coming toward you, and then all of a sudden it doesn't happen. It's just odd stuff. Were you looking forward to the snow?
Yeah. I mean, it's been, I'm kind of tired of the snowless winter. I don't mind the mild weather so much, but the snow has its purpose, and it really does protect perennial plants. And I find that maple sap seems to always taste a little better when there's a good blanket of snow on the ground that might be in my head. So it's sad not to have it down here in the valley. The mountains are all white nearby, but yeah, we were looking forward to it, you know, as long as it didn't cause any problems for people.
Yeah, you are, you know, talking about the plants and stuff. You specialize in that as well, don't you?
Yeah, So we work at Wild Hudson Valley. We work with native plant species. We grow plants that have historical cultural importance for native peoples in the Northeast, especially in the Catskills, Hudson, and Delaware valleys.
Wow. Awesome. So basically,
not as a nursery or anything like that. It's more, it's for educational purposes, basically, which happens in quite a few different ways, but I won't go into that right now.
Well, I mean, that's so you basically know that winter is needed up here.
Yes.
from saying that. It's been very odd winter of, you know, snow here, then like 3 days later, it's gone. It's absolutely gone. And no freezing, huge, amazing. We had one kind of polar vortex. That was nothing. And it's just, it's been very odd years. I don't know. So
yeah, it has been.
Yeah. So found this article out the other day. My friend Stomp from Sounds Like a Search and Rescue podcast sent me this. So dog tracks scent for over 2 miles to find missing child in the freezing cold. So in Massachusetts, a police dog is being trained for tracking down a child who was reported missing last week among freezing temperatures. Actually, this was more than last week. This was February 2nd. So Auburn Police Department received a report that a child had left their home without permission as temperatures were in the 20s. Officers began to search their area and were joined by troopers from Massachusetts State Police. They said that the child was found with their family from 2 miles away. So the child walked off. They didn't say how old the child was. So, I mean, child is, anybody that says child, it's young. So, but found them about 3 or 4 hours later, which is kind of critical for a kid to be out in the cold, freezing cold weather, because hypothermia could enter their body really easily and take over. So, and they just are starting to question why the child had left the home and what they were doing two miles away. For me, that would have been exploring, because that's what I usually did when I was a child. We just, I mean, our parents didn't care. They just let us walk out. Yeah, go ahead. I don't know about the winter, but maybe that was the case. They're just like, go ahead, be a child. But kudos to the dog for sniffing that scent out. It's amazing. Yeah. It's amazing what they can do. And if they're trained well, they can just do anything. And then dogs are love. And dogs are great. Crazy instance out here in the Northeast. Also, another article that I saw, California hiker's body recovered from Mount Baldy. Now, this has been going on for a while. This was the last updated 2 days ago, February 11th. And a woman who went missing after hiking on Mount Baldy during extreme weather conditions last weekend has been found dead and her body recovered. The name is really tough to say. Leafy Huang, 22 years old, was spotted by a person flying a drone in the area about 3:25 p.m. on Saturday, February 10th. The sheriff's department was notified, and they went up there to try to get her, but they couldn't get her because of conditions. And they found her around 7:45 on Sunday, 7:45 a.m. on Sunday. A rescue helicopter hoisted her out. Now, the crazy thing is they said that she set off at 2 p.m. in the afternoon on February 4th and was not heard from till after 4 p.m. that day. So to set off on a mountain especially Mount Baldy. If you know Mount Baldy's out in over in the California area, San Bernardino, it's also Mount San Antonio. I think it's San Bernardino region. To set out at 2 p.m. on any hike, that's going to be a crazy hike, is very, very weird and very odd to do so, because you only have 3-4 hours of daylight, and just so odd. And they said that the heavy snowfall, avalanche conditions, so everything wrong went in the wrong way. Rain, snow, all that different thing is just happening during this time. So she was last recorded. I don't know if anybody heard of this, but unfortunately, just 2 p.m. I mean, that's a little odd, don't you think?
Yeah, that's sad.
It's unfortunate. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I get to hikes at 8 a.m. just to get a parking spot. That's maybe that's why she left at 2 p.m. because that was the only time she could get a parking spot. So don't know. So, all right. So thanks, Justin, for shooting a little stuff right there. Thank you to the monthly supporters, Darren White, Vicky Ferrer, John Comiskey, Jim C., Michael Bongner, David Mead, Matt Smith, Denise Weiss, and Joseph Hayda, and Beth Anderson. Thank you guys for supporting the show. Also, have you ever wanted to learn more about hiking or backpacking, or even brush up on some of your old skills in the backcountry? Check out Trailbound Project, a hiking and backpacking school. Scott and Joe from the New Jersey Search and Rescue Team have amazing backgrounds in Wilderness First Aid, Wilderness First Responder, and the Mountain Rescue Association, and they are here for you to learn old and new skills of hiking and backpacking. They teach anything from first aid, map and compass, and many other skills that could help you and others while out on the trail. Check them out on their website and all social media platforms. Also, check out Outdoor Chronicles Photography. Molly from Outdoor Chronicles Photography specializes in adventure elopement and adventure couple photography in the Catskills, Adirondack, and the White Mountains. She's also an officiant for getting married and a licensed guide, but she is a story maker. Molly won't just give you photos, she'll give you memories that will last forever. Don't hesitate to get a hold of Molly on all platforms. So, Justin, I asked this, I don't know if you've ever listened to the podcast before, but I usually have something. I have something to drink. Do you have you have anything to drink at 3:30 in the afternoon?
Sometimes. I actually just had a tea of homegrown American ginseng and wild nettle and a few other plants that I'll sometimes drink in the wintertime in the afternoon.
Any alcohol in that?
Nope.
Not yet. That sounds good. I've not had the nettle tea yet, and I've heard it's absolutely delicious.
Yeah, it's very mild and green tasting.
But it's also healthy as heck for you.
Yeah, it's good for you, and it's very, very easy to find and harvest.
Yes, nettles are freaking everywhere. Do you have them an atrocious amount of them down in the valley? Or no, not as...
Yeah, we have a ton of both wood nettle and two species of stinging nettle and some other related species. Yeah, they're everywhere.
I would say to harvest the heck out of them. You get to have those things and they'll regrow instantly because those things are very, very... I don't know what the word to say right now. I'm just flustered with everything. So... I'm trying to give up on soda, and I'm having this new like light soda with some rum in it. So I just got back, like seriously at 3:15, I got back from my other job. So I went out and had fun bowling and hiking today. So we're going to talk about hiking. Have you been on any previous hikes?
Do you mean recently or?
Yeah, recently or within that you want to chat about, you know, gives people some... Outside.
Nothing that exciting right now, other than routine checking on trails for the Greenland Trust, where I work as steward and easement manager. And these are trail systems closer, in some cases, right on the banks of the Hudson River.
Nice.
So, you know, not recreational hikes, but checking on things, making sure there aren't trees down or bad erosion, you know, picking up litter and looking to see what's happening at this time of year.
What would you call those like trails? Are they easy going, nice trails?
Yeah, generally, yes. At the Brandell Point and the Willows, which is just north of Catskill, and the Mwignack Preserve down in Catskill.
Nice. I'll put a link in there for the Greenland Trust.
That would be great. The Greenland Trust, you know, more than half of Greene County is within the Catskill Forest Preserve, but the rest of the county is largely unprotected, and Greenland Trust is, you know, the only county-based organization working to protect the land and the other side of Green County and provide public access.
Nice. Definitely cool. That get more people out there, get more people to know about the Greenland Trust. I would love to, because everybody travels along, 87, going all the way up. So yeah. why not stop at an easy hike over there and outside, how do you say it? You know, I've heard controversial names, Cairo.
It's Carol.
Okay. See, once again, controversial, or Catskill, anywhere around there. They got hikes everywhere other than the Catskills. So definitely everybody's got to check out that place. I'll tag them in that. So excellent. Thank you. I recently went up Balsam Lake Mountain with my friend, Henry, on Sunday. That was fantastic hike, just all spikes and stuff, ice in the beginning. We wore them from the beginning to the end. Didn't get great amount of views at the top because there was like a little overcast, but just sitting, the ceiling was like right, like I'd have to say like 100 feet maybe to 50 feet above us. So it was really
cool
to have the flow of us, but it also blocked the view of any other places around there. And but Balsam Lake Mountain is just one of just a fantastic, easy, beautiful hike that you can always enjoy, and anybody can go on it. I mean, have you ever been up there?
No, I don't think so.
You got to go up there. It's such a great spot. Beautiful view, fire tower. It's a fire tower. Every fire tower in the Catskills is absolutely phenomenal. But went up there, and then today I went to right around in my local area. There's Betty Wilbur Davis State Forest, and it's just a nice sort of flat walking area that they are. I don't have views up here in the northern Catskills area that I live in, and more in the Susquehanna region. I got out, I got to smell the fresh air. It was nice and cold. It was 30 degrees, but with that wind, it was down in the 20s. I love the freezing cold. I don't know why I love it. It's just fantastic. But at least I got out once again. Had a good time with Henry on Sunday going up Balsam Lake Mountain. I did have plans to do like Indian Head or Twin, but I didn't go through that because just recent stuff with my family. My good old mom broke her hip, and she's now recovering from that. So she's kicking ass. So I'm very proud of my mom. But yeah. So once again, volunteer. Everybody's starting to make up their schedules for this year. I know that the 3500 Club, their trailhead stewards, are actually starting to ask for people to sign up. Catskill Trail Crew, I know I talked with Matt about this, and they're making up their schedules. Catskill Mountains Club Visitors Center, anywhere you can volunteer. I mean, the Greenland Trust, do you guys have opens for all volunteers?
We do. We're currently getting our calendar together, but we are definitely going to have volunteer opportunities this year. Both for trail work, removing invasive species, as part of river sweep, so cleaning up on the banks of the Hudson River, that's going to be in early May, and other opportunities, tree planting in the fall. So that'll be up in the Greenland Trust website over the course of the next month or two.
Awesome. That's why, and you know, anybody and everybody should volunteer. And we talked about this, Lori, on my last podcast, on the last episode. It's just, and take one day out of your whole 365 days in a year and volunteer, because it'll make a huge difference, and we definitely need it at any time. You know, anybody helping can make a huge impact. So definitely awesome. Once again, I'll tag Greenland Trust in there. Also, if you need stickers, let me know. Send me an email, send me a message through any social media. I'll send you a free sticker. Once again, free of cost. It's brand new. The new logos and stuff and like that are on it. So check it out. Send me a message or go to Camp Catskill. Camp Catskill has them as well. Oh, so we'll do really quickly a weather forecast. So for this weekend coming up, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, it looks to be not too bad. Some clouds. And then sat on Friday in the, like, looks like to be the low teens for temperature wise, and then with wind chills getting down into the negatives mostly all weekend. So this is right now, once again, it's Tuesday, and it looks to be, and this was from Balsam Lake Mountain, so some clouds on Friday, being high of 16, a low of 12 with a wind chill of negative 13. Saturday, light snow and then some clouds and then some sunshine later in the evening. High of 19, a low of 18, and then a wind chill of maybe -6 here and there. Sunday, clear and then some clouds, beautiful weekend, 18 degrees, 12 degrees low, and then a -6 of wind chill. So this is coming from the mountainforecast.com site, and this is for Balsam Lake. So I thought I would just throw that in there. And no snow up in the Catskills as of yet. That's what I've heard. But once again, bring your spikes until we get up in the high 70s. Just keep bringing your damn spikes. All right. So, Justin, I'm going to do the last bit of sponsors, and then we'll get on to the interview, sir. That sound good?
Sure.
All right. So, is it time for some new gear or hiking in the Catskills? Say no more. Camp Catskill in Tannersville has all your hiking needs. Footwear, socks, moisture-wicking shirts, freeze-dried meals, Catskill merchandise, and more. They have all the essentials for your hiking needs. Located in Tannersville and online, check out Camp Catskill. If you want free stickers, stop here. Also, if you're ready to hit the trails, make sure you take the scenic route. Our guides are here to help you with your goals, big or small, like Marcy or Slide or Lone of the Sewards. Check out the Scenic Route Guiding and Gear Rentals on Instagram and Facebook for more information. Also, if you mention the podcast, you can get 10% off. Use the code MOUNTAINLION. Also, check out Another Summit, a nonprofit program that leads outdoor adventures and activities for first responders for free. Activities like walking or hiking or even backpacking and paddling trip. Check out anothersummit.org for more information and dates for future events. Get a hold of me if you need to contact them as well. I would gladly help you with any one of these organizations. Let me know, send me a private message, and I'll do that. So let's get on to the guest of the night.
Let's go.
Usually I do a clap right there, but I'm not tonight. No, I'm just kidding. Tonight, Justin Wexler is going to join me, and we're going to talk about Native Americans in the Catskills. Now, this is a cool, interesting topic that I've always had a wonder about, because we all know that the Native Americans existed well on the Northeast side, especially, you know, you associate their names with the Native American cultures and stuff like that. And I've also wondered about the Native American cultures. What do they do? How do they get these names? What did they do up in the Catskills? There's not a lot to tell us about the Native Americans here in the Catskills for some reason. There's definitely everything to tell us about the white people, the white man, but the Native Americans for some reason are just kind of pushed to the side. I don't know why, but Justin's going to bring some good information here. I'm going to ask him some questions, and I do have more questions to ask. I'm actually going to add some more questions, but Justin's here. Thank you for joining me, Justin.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, man. Sorry about that little ramble. That was a very long ramble right there. Jesus. Sorry.
Oh, no, you're fine.
I'm all over the place today.
No worries.
So Justin, why don't you give a little background about yourself, go in depth as much as you want. And tell us a story.
Oh, sure. Well, I grew up in the Hudson Valley within sight of the Catskill Mountain Escarpment. I spent most of my life just outside Hudson, New York. And as a kid, got out into the mountains as often as I could. At about, I don't know, I would say in first or second grade, you know, I had already been obsessed with the outdoors as for my entire conscious life. And I soon realized that the people would have the deepest knowledge over the forests where I was spending my time would be the people native to, you know, who had been there for generations. So going to the school library, I soon learned that the native people of the Hudson and Delaware Valleys had been displaced 250 years before and were no longer living in the region. So that led to my lifelong quest to try to understand what the world looked like in the Catskill Mountain region and the region around in the centuries before colonization, as well as in the centuries after. And since early on in high school, I've kind of, my life's mission has been a never-ending search, you know, through archival research, going through archaeological reports, linguistic studies, as well as working with the native communities descended from the region who are today displaced to Ontario, Wisconsin, and Oklahoma to reconstruct what their culture was like before colonization, how they shaped the landscape here, and how the landscape shaped their beliefs. So in a nutshell.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's fantastic that you wanted to pursue this. What caught your eye about the Native Americans of the Catskills? Like for me, It's just that I read about them very little, and I was just like, wow, this is, why didn't they pursue into the Catskills much? What caught your eye about the Native Americans?
So, interestingly, so it really depends on how far back in time you want to go. And I've put all my efforts into what scholars might call the late woodland period. And so we're talking about the centuries immediately before and after colonization, before the Dutch showed up in the early 17th century. Well, the farther you go back in time, the more reliant you are on, you know, very thinly scattered archaeological sites. And I'm more interested in what we can identify with known groups of people, you know, with whose languages we're familiar with, you know, that's all in much more recent times. So I couldn't really be that helpful if you wanted to talk about human beings in the Catskill Mountains 7,000 years ago, but over the past 700 or 800 years, I could talk in depth. I think one of the reasons that there are so few books or articles published about Native peoples in the Catskill Mountains is just because the Native people whose territories were in the Catskill Mountains, generally, they did not live in the mountains, not within the last couple of thousand years. They spent most of their time closer to the Hudson and Delaware rivers, for a good, very good reason that I'll get into in a bit. But it does not mean they did not spend any time, nor that they were not intimately familiar with the Catskill Mountains. And the information that can tell us about, you know, since they've been displaced for so long, much of that lore is long gone. But by really, really searching through a huge amount of records from the 17th through early 19th centuries, you can actually really recreate the Catskill Mountain landscape and get an idea over how Native people over the past 300 to 400 years were spending their time in the mountains. It's just a lot of work.
A lot of work.
Finding little shreds of information here and there. I'm currently putting it all into a book. Specifically on Native people in the Catskill Mountains that hopefully will be published within 2 years.
Nice. Congratulations. That's awesome.
Thanks. Well, it's been a long... Their articles have come out on Native people in the Catskills for almost 200 years, but nothing has ever gone into this kind of depth. And it's time, you know, their story needs to be told.
Exactly. And, you know, I've like always, you know, there's always short, like inserts about it. And then all of a sudden it goes into the time when the Dutch came here. And then all of a sudden, you know, there's short inserts about it. And that's what stinks, is because the Native Americans were 100% reliant on themselves and reliant on their other, you know, just other themselves, basically. That's what, God, that sounded horrible. That's okay. But like they didn't depend on anybody else. And then, you know, just to hear very little about it in the Catskills, and you're like, what's going on? Why do we hear about it so much in the Mohawk area or other stuff like that? But the Catskills are left out. So that's great. Awesome news to hear. I cannot wait for that. I will support that in any way possible. Let me know.
Oh, thanks.
So, I mean, the beginning, of course, is what tribes were located here in the Catskills?
So that depends on how you define the Catskills. So I'm going to go by the, you know, how the Catskill Mountain region was defined in the 18th and 19th centuries. So basically between the escarpment in the east and around the east branch of the Delaware River. So we're talking the Catskill Mountain high peaks. Really, I mean, I could even extend that to the west branch of the Delaware River. And the entirety of that region really belonged within the hunting territories of two groups of people speaking closely related languages. In the north, we're talking about a group of people who came to be called the Catskill Indians. They spoke a dialect of the Mohican language. And to their south, a group that came to be called the Esopus Indians, they spoke a dialect of what linguists call the Munsee language. And both the Mohican and Munsee languages are in the Eastern Algonquian language family, which is a large language family that was once spoken from the coast of North Carolina up to the Canadian Maritimes. And only a few Eastern Algonquian languages are still spoken today.
Wow. So, were they ever, was that like a good strong line between the both of them, or were they like kind of like well cultured together or something like that, or were there always like those territory lines that you always hear about?
So these two specific groups, they regularly intermarried. They were very close. Their dialects seemed to have influence but one another. Again, that's, you know, because there are no vocabularies specifically recorded from these two groups of people, we have to rely on very thinly scattered words, place names, and personal names that are often written, you know, by people, more often than not written by people who didn't speak their languages. So it's a lot of work, and there's a lot that we'll never know. But they were very close to each other, as well as to other Lenape people in the Delaware and Hudson valleys nearby. If I was going to say there was any firm line of hostility, that would be with the Haudenosaunee people to the west. So with the Mohawks and Oneidas up in the western Mohawk Valley and very upper Susquehanna Valley to the west. And there definitely seems to have been a buffer zone between these groups of people in the upper Susquehanna watershed up and west of the Schoharie Valley. They certainly, according to their oral histories, where they really did not like each other. And
oh, wow.
Throughout the 17th century, fought each other until they finally made peace around 1670.
Oh, wow. And it's the reason why they don't like each other, I'm guessing, is land, you know, of like stuff like that. Like what's the way they're taught? Like,
that's a complicated question. Eastern woodlands peoples have very different reasons for warfare. Generally, warfare is not fought to take land or anything of a material nature. It has to do with something that anthropologists call the mourning war complex. Mourning as in mourning for the dead. So basically, if someone in your community is killed or murdered, they need to be, the gap of them missing needs to be replaced by a captive who could be adopted into their place and even take their name, which often led to wars between groups of people, you know, as they tried to fill the places of the missing. But in this case, according to the oral history of Lenape people in the Hudson and Delaware Valleys, many centuries ago, the Haudenosaunee people showed up from somewhere to the south or west and pushed into where they had been living, which was somewhere in maybe central New York and Pennsylvania, and pushed them basically out of where they had been living and forced them eastward. So I think that led to a lot of hostility between the two groups that, you know, lasted even to some extent to this day. Not oh, wow. More, you know, through making fun of each other and joking.
Yeah. Crazy. Yeah. I've always wondered that, you know, why do they fight in battle and stuff like that? And often I thought it was, you know, these areas were rich in culture of maybe like hunting, or this rich area was culture of maybe farming and stuff like that. And, you know, I didn't know if it was, you know, like the white people who just want greed and stuff like that, you know. So very curious. Now, you recently talked about like the language that they spoke were often different. Can we associate any like names of towns or stuff like that around the Catskills? I've always wondered this, names of towns of Catskills and stuff that associates with the Native American languages.
Yes. And there used to be, until the 19th century, there were quite a few more that were still in use by the non-native population in the Catskills. But ones that are still used today include Shandaken, Ashokan, Schoharie. There are quite a few more. Oh. Papactan, Pakatakan.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, there are quite a few place names left. Most of them are coming from the Esopus Indians dialect of Muncie.
Awesome. Like, I know Phoenicia isn't associated with the Native Americans, right? That's Dutch.
No, that's coming. That's actually, I think that probably came in with the New England settlers when it was very fashionable at some point in the early 19th century to name towns after places famous in antiquity in, you know, the Greco-Roman world. That's, so we get names like Phoenicia and Syracuse and Cairo, where I'm located. So yeah, that's coming in from a different reason.
Yeah, and then up north, you know, we got Susquehanna. You said Schoharie. I had no clue that Schoharie was located with the Indian or Native American. culture. Usayanta, definitely. That's another good one. That's another good story to see, to hear about and to talk about. What was also, there was a Native American story that goes on with Catskill Falls, correct?
Maybe. There is one that Washington Irving wrote about that he had heard as a child from an Indian trader when he was on a boat going up the Hudson River. But and there are some details of that story that make me wonder whether it's legitimate and whether it was something that the Indian trader had learned decades before from actual Native people of the region. But we'll never know for certain.
Right.
All the Native stories of the Catskills that I know of, they mostly were made up in the 19th century. Very typical stories of, you know, young maidens committing suicide at waterfalls, and they're really very silly, and they're very commonly found throughout the Northeast, especially in touristy areas.
Of course. Well, I was just curious. Like you said, that you've dug so deep into this certain topic that you'll find stuff that wasn't actually told, or was false information. And I'm excited for this book because I want to know so much. I can't wait. So when they first settled here, can you chat about that, like where their area sort of, not, I wouldn't say boundaries, but I've heard a lot about them not pushing more into the mountains to stay along the Hudson area. Yeah. And the escarpment. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. And again, I'm just going to talk about recent times, so like the past 1,000 years, because once you go farther back than that, it's harder to say. But yeah, during that time, we're talking about a time period when the local people, like the Catskill Indians and Esopus Indians, had a culture that was very much reliant on two things: on maize-based horticulture, so growing corn, sunflowers, beans, squash, and some other interesting crops, as well as on the anadromous fish, so fish that come up freshwater to spawn, that come up the Delaware and Hudson Rivers. So we're talking striped bass, shad, blue-backed herring, alewives, and sturgeon, short-nosed and Atlantic sturgeon in the Hudson River, much farther down in the Delaware. So you know, with those two resources, they were very much reliant on the lowlands and the floodplains of tributaries of the Hudson and Delaware River. And when I talk about the Delaware River tonight, I'm really focused on the very upper Delaware River, the East Branch, West Branch. I'm not really talking about the main stem, you know, and then tributaries.
Yeah, like Delhi area, up in the Stanford. Yeah,
even more Margaretville area.
Okay.
So they were spending most of their time down in these lowlands. And we know that by the tree species composition, which is something that, have you interviewed Dr. Kudish about the forest composition of the Catskills?
I interviewed him, but not about the forest composition. I have interviewed him and I'm a friend of his. So he's fantastic.
Amazing. He really is an amazing guy. Well, he's something that he's noticed. It's something that myself and a number of scholars throughout the Northeast have noticed, which is that you can basically tell whether you're standing within a few miles where Native people were growing corn and had their settlements in the past few hundred years by the trees. And as long as you're seeing a really diverse composition, including trees like white oaks, black oaks, hickories, more fruit-bearing shrubs like blueberries, let's say, or sweet fern, you're usually within a few miles of an area that was really important for Native people. And that's entirely due to the prescribed burns that they were using, you know, in order to clean out the forest understory, to drive deer to certain locations. They used fire for hunting. And there were a lot of positive side effects in select areas through the burns that they did. But you can see that very much in the upper Schoharie Valley, the East Branch of the Delaware River, and the southern Catskill, you know, southern and east Catskills, Catskill Escarpment, those are all places where they were living year round. It's when you get to the interior high Catskills that they were spending a lot less time, where the forest becomes much more dominated by beech trees and hemlocks and sugar maples. But people have argued for a while now, a very small group of people, that they didn't spend any time or very limited time in the mountains. And while that's true, there were some very good reasons for them to be spending some time in the interior Catskill Mountains. And in addition, the Catskills actually provided a place for them to retreat to. So not just in terms of their own wars before colonization, so, you know, in wars between different Native peoples, but I'm talking about as they lost their land closer to the Hudson and Delaware rivers, as they were forced to sell off their land to the colonists over the course of the 17th and 18th centuries, and as the land got more and more environmentally degraded from overhunting and dams going up on streams and stuff like that, they had a huge buffer behind them by having traditional territories up into the Catskill Mountains. And you can trace how the Catskill and Desopus Indians moved into the Catskill Mountains over the course of the 18th century. And they were really very fortunate to have that behind them.
So a lot of, you know, I was actually going to ask you about that burning stuff, because I know a lot of different places that you can tell. And then I was told that, you know, like there's a place on Ashokan High Point where you go down into the, it's called the Knob. And I heard they burned that whole knob, and that's why it's all shrub and it's all blackberries and blueberries and stuff like that. That's where the Native Americans used to have a rich area of like not farming, but they used to try to farm up there, and that's where they would burn a lot.
Yeah, down in the Esopus Valley over there, that was a place where they did have communities and where they were growing a lot of corn. The fires that were happening up in the uplands were to improve their hunting. So through the fires, creating that disturbance, bringing in new plant species, increasing the fruit and nut yield of different trees and shrubs, and providing more grass and, you know, edible plants to feed game animals like deer, elk, turkeys, and some species that we no longer have, which I guess elk count, but species like heath hens and bobwhite quails.
Wow. Smart. Very smart. And I heard a lot of time they're spent on the escarpment, you know, facing more towards the northern escarpment, was more of like overlooking the lands on the flat areas. And they would like, there would be a scouting area, correct?
Maybe during the American Revolution, there are records of the Catskill Esopus Indians, who by that point had been forced into refugee camps outside Fort Niagara, where the British Indian Department was supporting them. And they were using the Catskill Escarpment to spy on the Hudson River Valley below and relay information back to the British command. Mm-hmm. But I don't know about, you know, before colonization, how they were using the escarpment. We just don't know. They're, as far as I have not come across any documentation, I do know that culturally going up to high places to this day is, you know, something that they will do for prayer and different reasons. And I'm sure they were doing that as well as being able to survey their country. So,
yeah, that's what I kind of meant is, you know, they would go up to the escarpment and look down on the Hudson Valley and see, you know, where would be good land to maybe build some crops, or, you know, this looks like a dense forest. Maybe there's deer over there, or like you said, elk at the time. So crazy, you know, and like you said, you know, you're talking about maybe going up to the high peak for sacred rituals. Now, is there any traditions in the Catskills that you've heard of or read about that you would like to chat about?
No, not that I could think of, but we do have some clues. So we have Big Indian is a good example. So the name Big Indian, there are quite a few different stories about that name. They were mostly recorded in the 19th century. Yeah, I'm not going to get into the different stories, but the one thing that most of them have in common is a record of an actual tree. So usually it was described as a large white pine tree, if I'm remembering correctly, in that area near the banks of Esopus Creek. And on it was carved a figure of a big Indian. And more likely than not, this is a reference to a false face, or what you call in their language, in the Munsee language, Masingwa. So this would be a carving that has spiritual importance. And we don't know why they carved it in that spot. It was still standing there after they were driven out of the region during the time of the American Revolution. They did have a major trail that passed through that area that went from their original settlement closer to the, you know, Hudson Valley, lower Esopus Creek, the Rondout, that went over Pine Hill to the East Branch. But yeah, that's an example of one good example of, you know, their spirituality that survives in a place name.
Okay. Now, are you, what do you think about, what's your opinion, thoughts about the Karens that they talk, the Native American Karens that go from, you know, the Long Island all the way up to the Susquehanna area, possibly? What are your thoughts and research about those?
So humans have been here a long time. It gets farther and farther back as archaeologists uncover new evidence for how long human beings have been in the Americas, maybe farther back than 20,000 years. And, you know, that's in places where the ice sheet was not covering. Obviously not the Catskills where there was an ice sheet. But my point is, we don't know who was here and what their customs or languages were like, let's say 10,000 years ago. So there very well could be stone structures, monuments, cairns that were put up by people so many thousand years ago that they're long gone, and the stories that went with them also are gone. However, I have heard a lot of almost conspiracy theories about various stone structures spanning across the Northeast or parts of Eastern North America that, honestly, I find them really silly. There is an absolute huge wealth of data left to us from surveyors in the 18th and 19th centuries, as well as travelers in the 17th through 19th centuries, who described they were always looking for anything interesting. And if they had been coming across stone walls, stone cairns, they would have been noting them. And they largely failed to note them. And in contrast, we have abundant evidence, including many local municipal laws regulating stone fence or stone wall construction, and which was a huge part of the culture in the late 18th and early 19th centuries in parts of the Northeast, especially when the New Englanders, you know, during the time of the Yankee invasion in the Catskills, that's all well documented as well. However, I will say that there is a history of Native people in the Northeast building huge stone monument piles in certain locations for all different reasons. Sometimes they were located to mark the graves of extraordinary individuals, sometimes to mark spots where huge battles happened. And as often as not, these stone monuments were used to mark boundaries between groups of people. And we know of a number of these. I can think of six off the top of my head that were recorded just around here. Most of them are gone. The vast majority of these huge stone piles were disassembled 200 to 250 years ago by settlers who used them to build stone walls or foundations for their houses. But there was one on the edge of the Helderberg Escarpment in Albany County, another one in Columbia County just across the Hudson River. I don't know of any in the Catskill Mountains that are definitively Native or associated with the Native people who we knew lived in the Catskills a few hundred years ago, but it's certainly possible that there are some.
So that, like, you know, I see these things all the time, you know, the big massive cairns and the serpentines, you know, that they say that mark the water and stuff like that. And a lot of times I always just like, if stone walls from built, you know, 60, 70 years ago can't last, how could these stone structures like that are the size of like me and stuff last for 2,000 years or 1,000 years? Like, I wonder that. And I'm like, Indian, you know, the Native Americans are smarter than that to mark where water came from, because they always were around water. Water was their precious area that's, you know, was their hunting grounds for fish. They always fished. Their traveling areas were water. And, you know, I see that as funny sometimes. And a lot, my friends have pointed that out too. You know, people have said, like, up in the Ashokan area, there's cairns all over the place. They're big, you know, 6-foot cairns. And what do you think about that? You know,
I think the vast, vast majority were built by farmers or even by, who knows, eccentric people in the 19th century. By the way, the stone monument piles I mentioned, the known ones that have had importance to local Native people, these are way bigger than 6 feet. We're talking like 10 to 20 feet, you know, in height and 40 feet wide.
Oh, wow.
Way, way bigger than the stuff that people are finding today. So,
wow.
Yeah, and these were not built, you know, all at once. This goes back to a tradition that still survives of placing a rock annually or placing a rock as you pass by. And to this day, the Mohican people from the reservation in Wisconsin, when they're visiting some of their ancestral land, they will place stones and known sites where these stone monuments existed.
Wow. Yeah, it's just a big topic that's going on right now and has been going on. It's been researched a little bit further. And like you know, talking to someone like you has dug deep, way into depth in this, you know, I like to hear different opinions. And, you know, with the Native Americans, like you said, there's very little information. And it's amazing to hear some of this stuff. Now, being with you, digging deep into this culture and to their background, what is your favorite, like, Native American tradition that you can think of? What was, like, caught your eye when you're reading about this? Caught your eye? Well, yeah.
And to keep it Catskill related, one tradition that I think is pretty cool is the annual passenger pigeon hunt. And we only have a few records, and they're very small, of passenger pigeon hunting in the Catskill Mountains. And for listeners who are not familiar with passenger pigeons, this is a bird species that has only been extinct for a little over a century. And these are beautiful pigeons. They looked more like mourning doves, but more colorful and larger. They had shades of blue and pink, and they flew in flocks that could number in the tens of millions. For about 20,000 years, these were the most abundant bird species on the planet, and they lived specifically in eastern North America, eastern United States, and Canada. And they flew in these giant flocks only during certain times of year when they were migrating, but during the springtime, they bred pretty much exclusively in old growth beech forests. So they would arrive in the interior Catskill Mountains about mid-April, and specifically in places where there were huge amounts of beech trees. And there are a number of places in the Catskill Mountains to this day named for the pigeons. So you'll see places like, you know, Pigeon Brook or Pigeon Hollow, or, you know, there are a few places left. And these birds would nest in such vast numbers that trees would collapse from their weight in the night. Branches would break. The guano could be a foot deep on the ground. We have many, many eyewitness accounts over the centuries. And there is a custom throughout the Northeast for any Native people who lived within walking distance of these pigeon nesting grounds showing up for about a week every year in late April or early May and knocking the squabs, so the baby pigeons, out of their nests using poles at nighttime by torchlight, and harvesting thousands and thousands and thousands of these squabs, which would then, you know, those not eaten fresh would be dried over a low smoky fire or boiled, and many, many gallons of oil for cooking rendered out of them. And they wouldn't have even put a dent in their numbers by only going for a week. You know, that was only for a certain period of the pigeons nesting. The pigeons would just lay new eggs. And actually, they were very conservation-minded when it came to the pigeon hunt. And we have records of Native people in New York State in the 18th century complaining about settlers shooting the adult pigeons. They themselves, at certain times of year, they had seasons when they hunted these pigeons, and they were very, very, you know, in sustainability minded, but still harvesting numbers of pigeon squabs that you can't even imagine today.
And those passenger pigeons, were they named after being passengers for something, or just because of their long flights?
For their long flights. So okay. These flocks, you know, after the breeding season, and again, the reason for breeding in the beech trees, beech nuts drop in the fall and they sprout in the spring. And so the pigeons would flock in, you know, the thousands or millions and go over the forest floor eating beech nuts and, you know, smaller acorns and things like that, elm and maple seeds. But once the breeding nesting season was over, the flocks, they would disperse for a few months, and then they would get back together in these flocks that would blacken the sky for hours, and they would travel all over the place. Yeah, they would travel throughout the Southeast in the wintertime, the Midwest. They were driven to extinction partially through habitat loss, but really between 1870 and 1890, when market hunters began following the flocks by train, using everything from nets to cannons, basically, just massacring these birds and selling them for dirt cheap in cities off of the railroad like Chicago or New York.
Wow. I didn't know about that. Wow. That's crazy. What about, you know, you were talking about Native Americans outside of the Catskills. What's your favorite tradition outside of the Catskills? I'm sorry if you don't.
No, that's just a huge question. I don't know if I could answer that quickly. I mean, if you could narrow down what kind of tradition you might be.
Name anyone possible. First that comes to your mind.
Well, maybe this isn't a tradition, but the name Catskill itself. So people for three centuries, all the way back to the 18th century, have given all different theories over the name Catskill and what it means and where it comes from. And only a handful of recent scholars, like in the past few decades, have come upon this theory, which is I also hold to, that the name Catskill actually comes from a person's name. So it was very common in the 17th century, especially between the 1620s and 1660s, for the Dutch settlers to name places after prominent local native leaders. So we have examples all over the place, like Papaskenny Island near Albany. I'm right next to a stream that flows into Catskill Creek called the Yondebacher's Kill, named after a local Catskill Indian leader. There are many, many more. And we have records of a local native leader between the 1630s and 1640s or 50s who went by the name, recorded name of Kankat or Kat, which might come from the Mohican word Nikankat, which would refer to someone who is leading a group of people or the head paddler in a canoe. It could have all different meanings, lead dancer. So this leader was only mentioned in a couple of different records, but he was located in the Catskill area, so where Catskill, New York is today, and where Catskill Creek is. So the creek or kill being in 17th century Dutch word for a moving body of water, might have been named, and I think likely was named after this guy Kankat or Kat, so Catskill. And the mountains were then named after the creek. That's no one argues with. You know, they're the mountains that are visible as you come up the Hudson River from the mouth of Catskill, the Catskill Creek area. So I strongly believe the name comes from a local Catskill Indian leader, which it's funny to say that because that his name is within that.
I think that's awesome. And we're talking about, of course, like Catskill Falls and Catskill High Peak, K-A-A-T, right?
No, that's a different origin.
Actually. Oh.
They just happen to sound similar, but yet Catskill comes from a archaic word for waterfall or cataract.
C-A-U-T?
And refers actually probably not to this all the series of huge falls in Catskill Clove, but to a few smaller but still really spectacular waterfalls found down in the lowlands of Catskill Creek, so closer to the area between Saugerties and Catskill today, High Falls being one of them. I mean, there are many places called High Falls. You won't find that looking it up on Google very easily. But yeah, there's another one, Catspan. So that's located down towards between Catskill and Saugerties. Not related either. It means the tennis field or tennis court in Dutch. Oh, wow. Refers to likely to a field where the Esopus and Catskill Indians had joint lacrosse games. The Dutch not being familiar with lacrosse, but very familiar with tennis. You would have seen the lacrosse sticks and, you know, compared them to tennis rackets. So three cats, Catskill, Catskill, and Catspan, all have completely different origins and meanings.
And spellings, right?
Yes. Yep.
Oh, wow. Awesome. Awesome. How did you, that one guy's name that you think that's named the Catskill area, how was that spelled?
C-A-U-T? So it's C-A-T in one source and in another, and it's likely the same individual. I think it's like K-A-A-N-K-A-T.
Oh, okay.
Their names, you know, these are names of people written down by outsiders who did not speak their language usually and really could garble them writing them down. And they're often spelled in many different ways. I mean, Catskill itself is spelled in dozens and dozens of different ways, especially back in the 17th and 18th centuries.
Yeah, definitely. I can tell you that I've seen it at least like 5 or 6 times. So seeing it 12 times has got to be absolutely insane. So Did the Native Americans like have any influences on the Catskill area? Farming was probably huge with the, I mean.
Yeah, well, they exclusively farmed in floodplains. So, you know, anywhere where they had was pretty much stone-free, silt soil. And basically the areas where you see corn being grown today. So, you know, down in the area between Kingston and Marbletown and Saugerties, or between Catskill and Freehold, or parts of the Upper Schoharie Valley or East Branch, the places where corn is being grown today are the places where they were growing corn in the past. And so these were very open, often treeless environments down closer to the streams. But as they were forced into the mountains in the colonial era, they probably began growing corn in places where they had not been before. So higher valleys up in the Catskills, I have records of some of them only remembered through the oral history of local settlers, but which I often take seriously, are records of Native people growing corn in parts of the West Branch of the Delaware River and the Beaver Kill that's connected to the East Branch, not the one that's closer to the Hudson River in Catterskill Creek. There are many Beaver Kills. And the Upper Schoharie. So Upper Schoharie closer to Prattsville. So as they were forced into these more inhospitable regions, they were beginning to, you know, further survival, grow their traditional crops at higher elevations, but still in the same floodplain environments. But really, you know, their lasting legacy besides place names in the Catskills is a forest, the tree species composition. And it's real. Everywhere you go to Catskill, if you're seeing white oak trees in the Catskill Mountains, or, you know, a variety of oak trees besides northern red oak, you are always within a few miles of where they had a known named settlement area within the past few hundred years.
So did we explain that before, why that is like that? Did you say because that was where they grew crops, or was
why? Because of the burns.
Burns. Okay,
yes,
sorry.
Anywhere they were growing corn, they were also setting fire to the woods and the uplands nearby, for hunting, but also just to enrich species diversity, make easier walking. It's entirely possible that these prescribed burns even reduced tick population.
Wow, they were smart.
Yeah, I mean, fire to manage the landscape, you know, that's something found all over the globe by Native people. I mean, all of our ancestors at one place or another have used fire to manage the landscape on every continent where humans live.
Yeah, awesome. Now, what is... if we're going outside of the Native American things of the history of the Catskills, what do you find like a fascinating story that you hear about just a Native American culture in the United States? What comes to mind?
I don't know. That's a tough one. That's such a broad area with so many different languages, cultures, and history. I don't know if I can answer that. That would take me a few hours.
Oh God. I wish I had a few hours then. I'd love to hear about that. It's just, you know, I think the stories of their hunting and the way they progressed and the way they, you know, took pride in their culture was just fascinating to me. It's always just fascinating. Their hunting was just so amazing. Stealth, what they used, what they had to use was just always awesome stuff to read about. And, you know, I'm not into depth as you are, but I'm learning more and more each time I read about it. And it's amazing to hear stuff about them.
Like, yeah. Oh, absolutely. One thing I guess I'll note is, so a few times a year when we have Lenape people come to visit their ancestral land from their current locations, so the reservations in Ontario, Wisconsin, and Oklahoma, we usually take people or individuals or groups up the Catskill Escarpment. So often because we have elders or little kids with us who can't walk very far, so, you know, easy spot where they can walk and get a real bird's eye view of a huge part of their ancestral land. But we also took a women's group with representatives from all of their contemporary displaced communities through the Catskills and up to the top of Mount Utsayantha this past October, as, you know, being a point traditionally that's for them, that's considered to be at the head of the Delaware River. Since you know they're in, they have an ancestral link to both the Delaware and Hudson rivers. You know, it's kind of one group of people descended from the Hudson and Delaware river valleys, which is why their communities today are often called Delaware Indians. Even in some of the communities are largely descended from the Hudson River. And just to see, you know, I've felt very, you know, fortunate to be in the presence of people who have these ancestral links to the land, just to see like what people are going through, the emotions they're experiencing, climbing up the mountains and seeing their homeland sometimes for the first time. You know, people often cry thinking about it. It's really beautiful to witness.
Yeah. Is that story about Uncianta true?
No, that's another one of those stories that's from the 19th century. Yeah. It's
now,
the name is for Mohawk or Oneida, and I'm not an Iroquoian like specialist, so I couldn't tell you the etymology with certainty, but I think it refers to a stream or a spring near the bottom of the mountain.
Okay.
But that story is just another one of those legends that were made up during the touristy times of the 19th century.
Yeah, there's so many I hear of those. You know, when my friends uncovered something about the Big Indian area, like that was the same exact story, that one of the Native American women's had a baby with a Dutch settler.
Yeah.
And it was like Mulanu, like my wife's last name is Mulinex, and I saw it and it caught my eye and I read the whole story, and it's the same exact story, you know, like they had a baby together and then the lady was crucified, or, you know, for either for the Dutch, because, you know, the Dutch went with the Native Americans, they didn't like the Native American, or the Native Americans said, like, you know, they are not to be whatever, that they shouldn't be with those. That it's just, I hear that a lot.
Yeah, it's the same story repeated in different formats everywhere in the eastern United States.
Okay.
And by the way, like there was intermarriage happening between the settlers and Native people, both black and white settlers. And I don't think anybody from any of the sides frowned upon it. I mean, many of the ideas of race that we have today didn't exist in the 17th and 18th centuries.
Yeah, crazy. Awesome. So how can we learn more about like Native American heritage here in the Catskills? What is your suggestions?
So that's a great question, because there are so few publications for general histories of the Catskill, that Catskill Mountain region, that go into a little bit of depth on Native people. Really, Alf Evers is still the place to go, you know, any of his books. But if you want something more modern that goes into greater depth, specifically on the Native people who call the Catskill Mountain region their home, I recommend to everybody to read The Memory of All Ancient Customs. And I should ask him how he pronounces his name, but I still haven't, and I actually owe him an email. But the scholar who wrote that, hold on one second. It's Tom Aaron Mintrod. So, and I could send you a link after, his book, which is about how Native people in the Hudson Valley dealt with the colonization, is just extremely well researched and written in a way that is accessible to the layperson, and does go a little bit into the Catskill Mountains.
What was that?
Really, there isn't anything.
The Memory of All Ancient Customs.
Yes. Yep.
Awesome. Awesome. I will tag that in there. I'm going to try to spell his last, or say his last name. Oh yeah, Tom Arne Mintrod. Yeah, it's.
Yeah, I have to ask him. Unfortunately, there are a few publications that go into depth on Native people in the Catskill Mountains that have been published in the past few decades, but they're completely full of nonsense and pseudo history. So, yeah, you really can't. There's a lot of baloney out there, unfortunately.
So, have you have you met with any like local Native American people that have told you some stories and such like that, like firsthand?
Well, no, because they were all there. There is no one left. They were all displaced. So today they live in Ontario. So the Native people in the Catskills mostly live in Ontario today. So their descendants live in on the Six Nations Reserve at Grand River, Muncie Town, and Moravian Town. So three reservations in southern Ontario. there are other descendants living in the Stockbridge, Muncie Band of Mohican Indians Reservation in Wisconsin, as well as among the Delaware tribe and Delaware Nation in Oklahoma. But the very, very few individuals who stayed behind after the American Revolution, those who were not murdered after the American Revolution, because there was a lot of paranoia after the war, they tended to just get elderly and die out, like just and die without leaving descendants in the area, their descendants having been forced west, with a couple of exceptions of people who intermarried with local non-Native people. I can think of two or three examples of that. And within a generation, you know, the memory of that ancestry was forgotten.
Wow, so, that sucks.
Yeah, and because they've been displaced for 200 years, any folklore, anything to do with the Catskill Mountains is probably gone.
Oh, wow.
You know, like they've really held on to their many of their traditions and their culture, especially with hunting, medicines, fishing, many stories, with spirituality. But there really isn't any reason, if you're living in Ontario or Wisconsin for 200 years, there's not really good reason to pass down from generation to generation a story about a mountain peak or a river in the Catskills. And so that kind of stuff, unfortunately, is very hard to come by. I will say, though, that a friend of ours from Ontario, who's directly descended, her last name comes from a leading Native family in the Saugerties area that spent a lot of time in the Catskills. But when she was visiting us last summer and we took her up into the mountains up near North South Lake, she was looking at a sign of the forest preserve. And she was immediately picking out names. And so she's a language teacher for the Muncie language. And she immediately saw Shindaken and translated it, which is really cool. You know, she saw it instantly.
What does it mean?
It has,
do you remember?
The first part of the word refers to hemlock trees. Okay. And it likely refers to a stream with banks really densely crowded in hemlock trees, probably to the upper Esopus.
Nice. Awesome. Awesome. And, you know, have you done anything that we can check out besides this new book you're coming up?
No, I don't have any publications on this topic that are available right now, but I'm regularly doing presentations about both the animals that were found in the Catskills until fairly recently, like elk and wolves and some other cool ones, passenger pigeons, as well as on the Native people's recent history of the Catskill Mountains in the last 200 years. And I'm doing presentations and guided walks all over the region. So yeah, if you could go on the calendar at our Wild Hudson Valley website or join our newsletter. And we also host Native people visiting their ancestral land in the summertime and fall, to talk about their own history or culture. So there are also opportunities to get to meet people, Native people descended from the area.
Awesome. Yeah, I will put that link in there and stuff. One question. I see that you were on the Cats Cast podcast.
Yes.
I hope this is not kind. What about that? I'll ask this question. What about that PDF? Is that something you did?
Oh, yeah. Yes. Okay. So I could share that. Yeah, you could share that with listeners.
Okay.
Yeah, Yeah.
Go right ahead.
Well, yeah, I created a handout. Originally, it was for educational institutions. Basically, it's just a list of the most trustworthy sources on the history in the region, a link to the contemporary tribes whose ancestors come from the region and where they're living today. It's a few pages, also a glossary defining who these different Native groups are, because there's a lot of confusion around names. So Okay. Yeah, I'll send that to you and you could share that.
Sweet. I will share, I'll put that, like, tag it in the show notes and stuff like that. So Justin, thank you for joining me tonight. I really appreciate it. I'm glad you took out your time. You know, it took a while for us to get together, but
yeah, sorry about that.
It's, no problem,
man. It's
been
a rough year for us, just overworked and overwhelmed.
Listen, man, I am 100% glad that you can join me. You know, I do this for fun, and so, you know, it's tough to get people influenced to do it on their own time for fun. But then once they do it, they're like, holy crap, that was really fun. So, but I'm glad you can join me. It was great hearing about that. Maybe, like, we'll hook up again and do this again, but a little bit more in depth with a little bit more questions. But really appreciate you joining. One last question. Post-hike bruise and bites. When you go for a hike or when you're out in the Catskills, Where do you suggest to go to get something good to eat?
Oh, that's so.
Yeah.
In season when it's open, where we like to go is. Oh my God, I'm getting a mental block right now just from being tired. So in Round Top, so we most of our hiking in the Catskills is at trailheads within 10 minutes of our house. So from the other, you know, from the valley sides, so they tend to be brutally steep with like 3,000 feet elevation gain. So we're going straight up to North Point or up the Blackheads or, you know, Windham. So when we're down at the bottom, we really like to go to Mountain Brow House. And that they're not open in the winter, unfortunately. There are still a few, and that's not the one down in Gardner, New York. It's down in Round Top, but they have a really, it's just nice to get. We both, my wife and I, really like wheat beer. So we can get good German wheat beer. And, you know, especially after a long hike, we really enjoy some of the German food. So
nice. Hey, that's something that I haven't heard of yet. So that's great. Excellent. So thank you to the monthly supporters and monthly sponsors. Really appreciate you guys supporting and believing the show. Thank you to everyone who's still listening, 112 episodes in. And big thank you to Justin for joining me tonight. Check out his website, Wild Hudson Valley. So it's really cool stuff. Workshops, anything about harvesting. They have an event calendar up and everything. I will post that in the show notes. So check out his websites for nature walks. A whole bunch of stuff that it's just all over the place. You guys do a lot of stuff, and now I know why you're busy and tired all the time. But I appreciate you joining me on the show, and I hope you have a good night, and hopefully we can meet up in the future.
You too. Thank you. Have a great night.
You too, sir.
Talk to you soon.
Hey, everyone. I just want to thank you for listening to the show. If you enjoyed the show, subscribe and throw down a smooth review on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or any podcast platform that you use. You can also check daily updates of the podcast, hikes, hiking news, and local news on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and the official website of the show. Remember this, you gotta just keep on living in the Catskills, man.
Wicked, 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 wicked.